You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
As many of you know, this is a chaotic, disorganized thing that we do around here, so leave it to our show to do the 9/11 show several days after 9/11 and perhaps wonder aloud whether we should still be draping all of these sporting events in the American flag, in patriotism, in everything that you have seen happen over the last week. So we bring in our brain trust here at Meadowlark, and I'll start with you, Howard. You experienced everything that has been happening in sports over the last 20 years with the symbolism of 9/11 and with the remembrance and the heroic salutes of frontline workers. You've experienced all of that. How?
Well, it's been something. It really has. I remember, well, I was covering the Yankees in on 9/11. So I was in New York, living over on 49th and 10th. And so we were sort of right in the center of it from all of the beginning, obviously the tragedy of it all, but also the marketing and the business part of it. I'm thinking about the Mets documentary being on last night. I know that's about the 86 team, but I was thinking about how one of the reasons why they started to sing God Bless America in the first place at ballparks was because George Steinbrenner was convinced that the Mets were getting a lot more publicity than the Yankees as New York's team during that period. Because remember, you had John Franco out there and Bobby Valentine when they used the parking lot at Shea Stadium as a relief area. And so George felt like he had to do something to measure up with the Mets. And so they brought in Ronan Tynan and they started to do God Bless America. And it's been here ever since. And then all the other teams in Major League Baseball followed up. And then the NFL did the same thing. And so the entire look and feel of our sports for the past 20 years has been shaped around 9/11, all of the induction ceremonies on the field and the flags and the flyovers and everything. And so I think over the last, even the last 15 years, we'd been thinking, okay, when was this? Was this temporary? Was this permanent? I remember talking to some folks over at the Yankees, and I remember George had said that they were going to be playing God Bless America and doing all this until the wars ended. Well, here we are. Over the last month, we've seen that the wars are officially over. And so my question, looking at the end of these conflicts, the pullout from Afghanistan, and now looking at this 20th anniversary of 9/11, I just started to ask a question: that has 9/11 become a permanent fixture in what sports looks like? When you look at the other periods, the other wars that we've had, the other conflicts, once those conflicts ended, all the symbolism and the jingoism, all that started to go away. But we've been at this for so long now. It is interesting to me, and I wonder what everybody thinks just about, is this what sports is going to look like from now on, even though the drawdowns from Iraq and Afghanistan are complete?
Is that blasphemy, Kate? Is that sacrilege?
It's an interesting question. Even when Howard first posed it, my initial reaction was that 9/11 and flags and military flyovers and sports, while the days after, like that Monday after 9/11 when the Yankees played again, certainly in that moment, it felt directly tied to 9/11. In the years since, it has been so abstracted and refracted and pulled away from what that moment was. And it has become almost like a stand-in. What we do before sporting events, beyond just the national anthem, in my mind, has become a stand-in for this kind of vanilla, bland idea of unity. Not saying that clearly this country is not unified, but it seems that 9/11 isn't even what it's about anymore. And that if we think it was about 9/11, then it's a good question to ask if the end of the war that was started by 9/11 will end this extreme militarization and politicalization of our sports. But because it's not even really about that anymore, it's about, in the same way that we have breast cancer awareness and there's pink in the NFL, it seems like this is that version of it. And there is nothing. There is no war, the end of the war that will like pull us away from what we do in sports. Because even if you go back to the very beginning, like the national anthem, it was the national anthem of baseball before it was even our national anthem. They started playing it in 1918 and like I looked this up, right? They started playing it in 1918 in the World Series between the Red Sox and the Cubs because of World War I and the somber crowd and, you know, this bomb that had gone off, like domestic terrorism the day before. And this moment of playing at the time, just the Star Spangled Banner before that World Series game, was this moment where the crowd seemed to connect and players on the field saluted. And it was like the only uplifting moment. And of course, and I read this phrase in an article about this, and the front office took notice that moment had connected the crowd to everyone on the field. So it's like, if the national anthem was baseball's anthem before it was our nation's anthem, then there's no chance that sports is ever going to stop being intertwined with the military and politics.
Kate, it's interesting you say that. They didn't play before the game. They played it during the seventh inning stretch. And that was just on a whim. The band was, I guess, it was a military band. And they're like, everyone seems kind of sad. Let's kind of pip them up here with a little Star Spangled Banner. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. But ultimately, it all seems to have roots into what today we call cancel culture, right? The idea that I always loved this scene from Blazing Saddles, where Mel Brooks is the governor and he's got all his lackeys in the room. And he makes a point. He goes, harump. And everyone goes, harump, 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 harump. And then he points at one guy and said, I didn't get a harump out of you. And the guy says, harump. He said, watch it, wise ass. This is the whole idea of like, if you're not doing this thing, then you're over there. And if you're over there, that means you're the enemy, which, of course, is kind of the rhetoric of George Bush. You're not with us. You're against us. Back when 9/11 happened. So it's all of these kind of weird individual strands and strains meeting together at this point where, Howard, you ask, well, now that the war is over, do we go back to what it was like before that? And the answer is no, not because we can hashtag never forget, not because this was the right thing to do and we should have been doing it all along, but because we've made it so that it's not about 9/11. It's about you showing which team you're on. And if you're not on this team, that means you're the enemy.
There's also, I was thinking about this as we were, you know, talking about draping the field in the flag and also the national anthem being a part of it, and thinking back about when I playing sports and before big games, or before any game really, at the college level, before any game, that moment with the national anthem, and this is before 9/11, but that moment before, while you're playing the national anthem, it always felt to me like it was very specific to sports. So when people say, why do you play the national anthem? They had become so intertwined in my mind as a very sensible, reasonable thing to be doing, because it's this moment, this small pause before you play the game, where it's almost like a quick meditation. If you ask a lot of athletes I talk to, will say like, it's this and this is aside from Kaepernick, but just the idea of the anthem playing, it's like you're warmed up, you've got that sweat going, and it's this moment where you pause and you have a moment of introspection before you play the game. And it's a moment where, like, this is again pre 9/11, where the athletes in the crowd kind of have the same energy that they're projecting before the game starts. And so and this was interesting to me, because I never thought that the national anthem shouldn't be played before a sporting event, because it made so much sense. It's not until you start really thinking about it where you're like, well, I go to Broadway plays and it's the same kind of thing, right? There are actors and it's a moment before they're going to go do the thing they love doing or are being paid to do. And there's an audience. So like, why am I not standing for the national anthem
I doubt that that's Howard's experience with the whole thing.
No, but this is how I was experiencing the national anthem. The point being that the national anthem in sports before 9/11 felt so intertwined to me that it made sense, because it had always been that way. Not saying it does make sense. In the same way that for some reason I think employment and healthcare should be intertwined. because it's always been that way. Even though if you take a hard look at it, you're like, that's actually a bunch of bullshit. Like, why are these two things intertwined? But yeah, I mean, Howard, like that, I think for a lot of athletes, the idea of playing the national anthem at a sporting event, like, it has been so commonplace. Not that it makes sense, not that there's not a lot of like, why am I standing up for this national anthem? But like, it has been going on for so long that you have to really examine it to unintertwine it, or whatever the word is when you deconstruct something being intertwined.
Well, things exist when you don't question them. And that's why things, you know, don't change. And most of us don't necessarily have the time or the interest in questioning them. That's what the journalists are for. That's what we do. We question stuff and then ask the questions about it and examine it. To me, I just felt like it's been a remarkable 20 years. I remember asking people in the late aughts, I think they're called, right? Right before we get to 2010, whatever that decade is called, right? They're called the aughts, right?
Turn of the century.
Yeah, why are we still doing this? And the number, to Amin's point, the number of executives who said, because we are not going to be the first team to not do it. We're going to get killed if we do this. I'm like, that's not a good enough reason. But then again, it might be a good enough reason for you, right? Because you don't want to be the one, as we saw when Mark Cuban tried to not play the national anthem, which had been going on way, way longer. I mean, you want to go.
Yeah. Howard, the best part about that story wasn't that Mark Cuban decided to stop playing the national anthem. Is that they had done it for several games and nobody noticed.
Like Kaepernick.
That's how vapid this thing is. It just proves you, like, you don't care. You only care when someone points it out to you, which means that it's not that important to you.
And now we have legislation. And I think the Texas legislature came out and said that it must be played after Mark Cuban did his little end around on the anthem. So I think, to me, that was part of it. But I think the other piece of it too was, I think that there was a, maybe it's simply because of the culture. None of us were around in 1918, so we don't know how anybody viewed it. And let's also not forget that 1918, you were at the end of World War I, and you had a Spanish flu epidemic going on. So I don't think people were in really jovial moods anyway, despite the World Series. But this idea of the anthem itself had been allowed to coexist while sports teams were actively trying to avoid any sort of divisive politics, because the minute you get divisive on your politics, you lose half your fan base, right? You're running into that sort of issue. That's not the case with 9/11. In 9/11, sports went all in on the politics. They went all in. It wasn't the players doing this. It was an entire apparatus following the attacks that brought in the first responders and brought in the military and had the cops singing the national anthem and then sewed the flags and everything else and the ribbons on the field and on the jerseys and on the referees' jerseys. All of those different uniforms, all of those different things created a business. And this has become part of the sports business. And I think that, to me, what I find interesting about that is that element of the sports business immediately collided within a decade with the other issues that were happening in the country. And we saw the players take them up, obviously down your way in Miami, Dan, when Trayvon Martin gets killed. It's the Miami Heat who do something that we had not seen since Tommy Smith and John Carlos, which was to make a political stance on the sporting field. And so when you take these two strains and you bring them together, this is the area that we live in now. This is what sports has become. And to me, for all of the people who start to talk about, well, you know, why are things so divisive? This is one of the reasons. So I started to think about this as we got to the 20th anniversary. And I began sort of asking the question, well, if this is a forever component of sports, who are we serving? I mean, what is being served here? Is it even necessary? Now, you know, and to ask the question, is this sacrilege, says how important people have decided this has to be to the game playing. And I just don't think it really is.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think. about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
You say that you see it in the games, the way that some of this stuff collapsed. But one of the things that I remember the most about 9/11 is afterward, how quickly what used to be news organizations that did not rah-rah, that were objective, even in the coverage of war, all of it collapsed.
Yeah, everybody got in line.
All of it collapsed on site. It collapsed where I'm watching the news, and it was very much, this is horrifying, we're afraid, let's take away civil rights, it doesn't matter what we have to do in airports to people, just racially profile if you have to, we have to protect everything here. But I was just surprised. I understand people arriving at that conclusion. I was surprised to see our news organizations so quickly put down their objectivity, and to Howard's point, the questioning, the asking of questions as our job.
It's a business. Dan, it's a business. That's part of the shift of news organizations and journalism going from their main objective is to break the news and to investigate and ask questions to their main objective is to return profits to shareholders. And guess what? Questioning whether this is the right thing to do around 9/11, around September 2001 and on, was bad for business. It was bad for business, I would say, up until the Iraq War. That's when you start seeing, wait a sec, is this a good idea? So there's a strong 3 years where it's like, again,
but that's how the grift happens. That's how the bogus wars end up happening.
It's beneficial, right? It's not just, hey, I don't want to be the guy that looks like the bad guy. It's also, hey, this is doing pretty good for us. From a sports team standpoint, look at the amount of dollars the U.S. Armed Forces spend in sponsorships and endorsements and of sporting events, commercials on TV, Army of One, all that stuff. Go to a game, they parachute down like little t-shirts and stuff. They have the team's logo on the front and in the back, it's got that Army star or whatever. This is all big business. Why does the military do it? Because guess what the military needs? Bodies. So they need that marketing machine going.
Yeah, I remember talking to the three-star general Russell Honoré about this, and he was phenomenal on this subject. He's phenomenal on most subjects, but he was really great on this subject because he just didn't care. He was like, listen, enrollment was down 20%. We need your kids. And I remember saying to him, I don't know if I want my kid watching a baseball game being recruited by the military. And he said, sorry. He says, but I tell parents all the time, hold on to them as long as you can, because we need them. And if somebody, some little 12-year-old is watching the Dallas Cowboys and an F-14 flies over before the game, and that motivates you to want to join, mission accomplished. And he was not hiding this. He's like, he referred to it as what we're looking for is what we refer to as the athlete warrior. And he was telling me about how sports immediately creates the athlete warrior because you have a bad guy. I'm Red Sox, you're Yankees, you're Cowboys, I'm 49ers. And it automatically creates for you a combatant attitude. And we're hoping that they're going to be in shape too. And if they're not in shape, we'll get them in shape. And that this is the place where we're going to recruit. Now, I believe in 2009, 2010, they pulled out of NASCAR because it wasn't helping. They weren't getting anything out of it, but the NFL, they get a lot out of it. And so to Amin's point, there is a business element to this too, but there's also something else, which is the idea that this arena is business partners with the war machine, right? That this is what we've created. This is part of it. And then when you take that and you combine it or you contrast it with the fact that you've got Black Lives Matter on the basketball court, right? Is there any, there's no going back from this. It appears. And I just thought that anniversary, I was really, really curious to see what that anniversary was going to produce, especially with the insanity that was going on with the with the Afghanistan withdrawal. And it appears that it was that there was no reaction at all. It was just business as usual.
There's probably more than two things, but two things pop into my mind in sports that you can't cross. And one is God and the other is patriotism. I mean, there's probably more than two, but these are the two that pop into my mind. Because I always remember a story from having from University of Colorado where even though it's a public institution, within our athletic department, within the facilities of the athletic department, every week we gave space to the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And they would come in and it would be a whole religious service at the University of Colorado that a significant percentage of the athletes would go to. And it wasn't always good for the coaches of the team to have a lot of their athletes going to this for various reasons that I won't get into. And I remember asking my coach, well, like, why don't you say something? Why don't you raise it with the administration that like you don't want FCA, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, on campus in our building? And she's like, do you think that I want to be the coach who then the recruits say, like, oh, she doesn't even believe in God. She wanted to kick FCA off of campus, even though there's all of these different layers for why they shouldn't be on there. And I think when I look at 9/11 too, and like what's been proliferated in these 20 years, it is in essence the merging of God and patriotism in one form that trying to say, well, is this right for all of the reasons we're talking about? Is it right that it is so ubiquitous on our fields and among our athletes? It's like, try being one of the people who's saying like, you know, you used your Blazing Saddles example, Amin, being the person who says like, no, I don't want FCA on campus. Like, that's not going to go over well. Same with in so many ways, like saying, well, I don't want a flag at a game. Well, like, okay, well, that means one specific thing. You hate America. That's what that means.
I agree. And I think the difference, is in all of this is that all of those elements that Kate's talking about, they've always existed in this country for like the past century. The difference is 9/11 itself. Right. That is the difference, because following World War II, all the World War II patches came off of the uniforms. Following the Gulf War in 91, which was not ancient history, it was 30 years ago. When that little war was over after the 3 months, however long it lasted, I don't remember who Duke played. Duke Vegas. I think they played in the final in 91. If you look at that entire March Madness, there were American flags and stuff on the court and stitched into the uniforms. And when that war was over, by the time you look at the NFL season and the baseball season, that stuff's not there anymore. So it's specific to 9/11. 9/11 changed the entire selling of sports. It changed the entire packaging and marketing and embedding of military into sports and made it permanent in a way that it had never been permanent before. And I think part of it, too, when we're talking about the, you know, not just the flags and the flyovers, but the fact that it was all bullshit anyway. The fact that in, you know, the two Republicans, you know, Jeff Flake and John McCain busted the leagues for doing this. They had been paying for it. It wasn't even organic. That most of the fans, when you were watching the game, whenever I tell people this, you know, you watch the games and you see the flag come running out there. And I said, you know, the military's paying for this. And they thought it was the teams doing their part. And it really wasn't. And even when you expose that, people will say to you, oh, well, at least it's for a good reason. Okay, it may be fake, but it's fake for a good reason. And I'm like, that's a new one on me.
The good reason. And yet, as we saw in Dallas, if we stopped doing it, you wouldn't even notice.
Well, what kind of leadership is that, though? Honestly, is the way to lead, you guys are citing examples of leading again and again by choosing not to lead.
It's not leadership at all.
Not wanting to be the one. Real leadership of all kinds risks unpopularity. But this is not a place where anybody wants to be first. There can only be first followers on this one.
No, 9/11 is a part of sports now. And I think that's what's been really, really interesting about this, is that in a way that I don't think any other, I don't know if there is a comparison to it. And I think that's appropriate in a lot of ways, because when you think about the generations, like if I think about, you know, my dad's generation, that is the Pearl Harbor generation. Right? This man wouldn't even buy a Japanese car for forever. I was like, dude, you own a German car, but that's besides the point. And, you know, for me, you know, Dan, we're the same age, right? You know, we're Cold War people, right? I mean, our entire generation was built about USA, Russia. That was the entire parameters of our lifetime. My son's generation is 9/11. Everything that he does, everything he lives in is through that prism. And the question, I guess it's, on the one hand, it feels provocative. On the other hand, sometimes it feels like it's not even remotely interesting, because it feels like, okay, can you even envision decoupling from this? Does anybody want to decouple from this? And I'm asking myself, why don't you want to? I mean, is there going to be such a thing as peacetime ever again? And it certainly doesn't look that way.
What is your relationship with the heroism that surrounds the first responders? Because we want to celebrate the first responders. Everyone likes heroism. Everyone likes the idea of bravery in the face of danger. But at the intersection of some of these things, patriotism in race and race, you have Black people who have a different relationship with police officers who behaved in that moment in a way that we can absolutely celebrate as heroism.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between, I don't think neither patriotism nor protest should ever be for sale. And I think the marketing and the logoing and the branding of all this is odious to me. I also think that there's a separation between 9/11 and what took place on 9/11. Like I said, I was on 49th and I didn't live there. And believe me, it was, if you weren't there, good. I remember, you want to talk about the harumph guy. I remember on 9/11, same day, because we had to go out like, okay, now you're no longer a Yankees reporter, you're a reporter. So we had to go down to Ground Zero and go try to find stories and such. I walk into a bar and there was this one woman on 9/11 that day talking about how America had it coming. I was like, holy shit, right? And nobody said a word to her because everybody was so busted. We were all like devastated, right? And she was like, this is the byproduct of 20 years of policy. And she was going on and on about policy. And this is what we get. Eventually, they were going to come for us. Eventually, there was going to be a response. And even the most, MAGA hard hat in that bar was like, yeah, because we got punched in the face that day. Right. I get it. But what I to your point, Dan, the first thing that hit me when I talk about that separation between 9/11 and the years that followed is that there was absolutely unity for a very short time. I felt American on 9/11. I've been afraid of America ever since, because what came after that was the, you're either with us or against us, right? There's the good guys and the bad guys, and the folks who were given this heroism, police, they were the ones kicking our ass. And now you had to bow to them and they got even more power. Police in America today are more powerful than they were on September 10th, 2001.
Absolutely. I can't express kind of the unease that I felt with this cape of invulnerability that the police walked around with after that as a result of 9/11, of that they can do no wrong because, look, they saved everybody and they ran into those towers. And by the way, absolutely, anyone who performed their duty on that day, hats off to them. But the idea that, if we talk about systemic racism in this country, we talk about slavery and Jim Crow and all the things that have happened throughout the history of this country with people of color, it's always like, you guys are still holding on to that? No, come on, just let it go. You got to move forward. You got to move on. We can't live in the past, et cetera, et cetera, until you get to 9/11. And then they put that hashtag never forget. And police officers across the country walk around with this shield. Bro, you're in Chicago or you're in LA. What do you have to do with 9/11? Just because you have the same profession? That doesn't make any sense. And so I think it's one of those things where the actions of a few people on that day serve as a sort of umbrella protection over all of the miscarriages of justice that this institution of police nationwide carries out. And it just kills me. In the same way that kills me that, for at least a decade in New York, and they probably still do this, but if you're walking and the street vendors are selling your Yankee hats and your Mets hats, and then you have the NYPD hat or an NYPD t-shirt. And I'm like, they're selling merch?
Yeah, they're selling merch. They're selling merch like they're a sports team.
Yeah.
And to me, what was crazy about it, especially in the immediate was how many people were using that as fashion statement. You had, you know, your $800 leather jacket on and an NYPD baseball cap. And to me, people would look at it and go, why are you getting so hyped about this? And the reason is because these are your jury pools. These are the very people who get called for jury duty when you have a police shooting and they're wearing an NYPD hat on like it's a baseball team. How on earth are you going to get justice? It's not going to happen.
Kate, I was just kind of curious in listening to you guys, because I think there's a, you know, you guys are ascribing politics to these pre-match or pre-game ceremonies. What for you is political about unfurling a flag and having the national anthem play? I mean, America is hardly the only country that celebrates itself before sporting events or before major events. What for you it makes it inherently political?
Well, for one, everything we've talked about going back to 1918 and before. So it's not just an unfurling of a flag. I think if we're just talking about what patriotism, the literal definition of the word, what it should be, what should be connoted when we say it, when we're like, okay, well, we stand for our country or you know, we're going to root for our country in a sporting event. That's completely separate from what patriotism has become and been a stand-in in this country, like what we ascribe to it, like Amin and how we're talking about police behavior, first responders, all of that. Like, patriotism doesn't mean patriotism anymore. It means defending our military no matter what they do. It means defending police no matter what they do. It means always being on the side of any law enforcement government agency. Like, that is what has been like shoulder to shoulder with patriotism for before 9/11. But if we're talking here about 9/11, like now it's like patriotism means this. It means all the things I just listed. I mean, it's to the point now where we're writing think pieces about, if I see a truck go by with an American flag, like I'm already, there's a lot of connotation that's happening there. And it's not, oh, they're going to the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team game. Like there's a completely different connotation. And I think part of what we are discussing now is that the intertwining of sports and military and jingoism and all of that is creating this connotation with patriotism.
That's right. These things were placed into sports. That is the point of all of this. It's not, you already had your patriotism with the Star Spangled Banner. You already had it. I mean, it's not as though, you know, and also when we talk about business and you talk about all of these other things, you're supposedly, you know, you've got an international game. I mean, majorly, how many people on a Texas Rangers roster right now are American anyway, right? I mean, they're different questions. Obviously, what you're doing is you're playing the national anthem because it's an American business. I guess that's the only rationale. You've got teams in Canada, right? I mean, so all of these different things make you wonder the incongruities of them all. But I think that the other piece of it that makes it that separates the patriotism question from what is the harm of patriotism, is my relationship with the New York City Police Department has absolutely nothing to do with patriotism. Nothing. You know, how I feel, even to some level, you know, how I feel about joining or not joining the Marines has very little to do with how I feel about being an American. That is a choice that for most people who join is more a financial choice than a patriotic choice. It's an options choice. So the real issue here is what we have done to this moment, like what this moment was and then what this moment became. And so to me, I make a personal distinction between 9/11 itself, when the world fell apart, where everything was falling apart. And it was really interesting. Kate was bringing up when baseball resumed, we drove because the Yankees opened up in Chicago. So we drove, nobody wanted to get on an airplane, obviously. So we got in the car, we drove from New York to Comiskey. And on the way, we're in Indiana or somewhere, and I go to pit stop or whatever, I'm in the men's room. And there's this, you know, dude that you would never talk to in a million years, and he would never talk to you, big old, good old boy with his beard and whatnot. And we're in the urinal, right? He's looking at me, I'm looking at him, and okay, we don't usually look at each other when you're in the urinal anyway, right? And so this dude looks at me and he goes, "You doing okay?" And I'm like, that shit never happens. Never happened before, never happened since. That's when you felt American, right? The rest of it became an apparatus, a for or against us thing. And to Kate's point earlier, when we brought it up, I don't know if you mentioned the word unity. There was no unity after that. There was none. I mean, especially living in New York.
It was the opposite of that. It was
the opposite of unity.
Us coming against that, against brown people, was really...
That's right. I remember all those ethnic restaurants on 9th Avenue putting American flags in their windows because they thought they were next. I remember the idea immediately following the pain of let's get revenge. Who are we going to get for this? And that was when the unity stopped. And then the rest of it became politics.
So Witte asked the question, what's wrong with patriotism? Well, patriotism is on the same, on one side of the coin. The other side of that coin is xenophobia. And that's what you're talking about, Howard. The difference between I'm proud of the United States or being an American versus I got to go get America's enemies. And enemies are anyone who doesn't look like me. For me personally, one of the things I remember on 9/11 is looking around and knowing, oh, shit, it's going to be a lot harder for people with a last name like mine. It's not a secret. I'm not a U.S. citizen. So one of the first things they did, I don't know if you guys are aware of this or remember this, but they rounded up all non-U.S. citizens who were Muslim or of an Arab descent or anything like that, basically anyone who had a funny name, and you had to go and you had to register with Homeland Security. And once they register, I'm talking biometrics before biometrics was a thing, when everyone else was just showing, flashing a driver's license to fly to the Dominican Republic, before, you know, went in, got fingerprinted, iris scans, all those things. Then they took down all of my financial information, my bank cards, if I had an account anywhere, if I had a credit card, they have all that information. That's why I always say I don't have any fear of ever being accused of something nefarious, because like, you guys already have that stuff. You know exactly what I'm doing. You know exactly what I spent my money on. Not in the, hey, Mark Zuckerberg is sharing your data with us. I know the U.S. government has this up because I handed it to them, because I had to. And, you know, not to mention my mother being harassed, walking down the street, not to mention, you know, countless family members. It was hell. And I knew that the day 9/11 happened, like after the shock wore off, I'm like, oh my God, this thing is actually happening. I said, oh shit, it's the end of it for us. Everybody else in this country is going to get over it in a couple of months. But in terms of like the fear or whatever, but the fear was only starting for people who look and sound like
Howard,
them.
I remember what you're talking about in that bathroom. I do remember a brief spark of unity where black guy and white guy were like, well, wait a minute, we got to be careful with brown guy. Like a brief spark of that. What will bring us together? The hatred of the other that is a different kind of racism.
Yeah, I remember being, it's so funny, it's not a 9/11 story, but I was in the DMV when I was living in Oakland back in the day, and there was this Asian woman, and she didn't know where she was going. She was older. She was in the wrong line or whatever it was. It was just some whatever it was, right? And it's like the classic stereotype, okay? And so then this white woman turns around and looks at me, and she goes, welcome to America. Here's your driver's license. And I'm like, we're not tight. Like, I'm not with you on this. But absolutely, that was the game. And so... And you do remember these things, because to me, the other piece of this, and the reason why this is important, is that that period also told you, or was a reminder to me, who they, who told us they were, that now they are heroes, who this country belonged to, who owned it, and that you weren't more of an American. You were saying, yes, you were reaffirming us. This is ours, and we're going to get whoever did this to us. And you could feel that. And I also think that when you feel that, when you're at a ballpark, and when you see the military induction ceremonies before a Falcons game or whatever, there is that reminder of that other, that it's a short subway ride between getting them and getting me, right? I mean, so all of these different symbols that you're sending out, these symbols weren't really supposed to be part of sports. Sports is supposedly the thing that brings us together, right? And this component, if we have completely normalized it to be now, it is ours, it is going to be what sports is going to be. But I still think it's completely worth asking, because inside the game, there are a lot of people who are like, why are we still doing this? But nobody wants to be the one to say, maybe it's time not to.
Kate, Howard, Amin, thank you. Appreciate the time. We will do it again, and I look forward to it.
All good.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.